This is The Gaggle with David Helfenbein.
This week on The Gaggle, we have on Emily Cadet. Emily is Newsweek's political correspondent, and Emily spearheads Newsweek's day-to-day coverage of politics from Washington, D.C. Emily, it is a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Emily, I want to start out talking to you a little bit about Newsweek and how Newsweek has changed more recently. Can you describe a little bit about where a lot of your articles appear? Are they all online? Does Newsweek have a print publication anymore? Can you go a little bit into background on what Newsweek is today?
Sure. Well, I came to Newsweek about a year ago, actually. I just realized, thanks to LinkedIn, that I'd celebrated my one-year anniversary. But I came on board after Newsweek had been sold by the Daily Beast and bought by International Business Times, and they have brought back the Weekly. So that's a common misconception that it's no longer in print. It is in print now. It comes out once a week. And I am sort of do a mix. I'd say like 70% of my time is on the weekly magazine pieces, and about 30 to 40% of my time is on web stuff. So it's juggling some of the short, fast daily news stories and trying to do some enterprise for the web, but also digging in a little deeper for the long form magazine articles.
And who determines what stories you write? Do you get to pick some of your own? Do you have an editor? How does that process work?
My editor's in New York, but yeah, it's pretty collaborative. I'm sort of a solo operator in D.C. and on the road on the campaign trail. I'm usually pitching back stories to them, saying, I think this is really interesting, or I've been following this news story, and I think that there's a piece here that hasn't been covered yet. I mean, a lot of what we're trying to do is sort of bring a little bit more context to sort of the day-to-day news. It's always the challenge. There's so much noise in this race and this election cycle. So what is missing from the dialogue, and sort of the blessing and the curse is that I can take a step back and try and make sense of some of the things that are happening so rapid fire on a day-to-day basis, and sort of try and string together what this all means.
Let's talk a little bit about the campaign trail. What have you been doing on the campaign trail this year? Have you been traveling on all campaigns, or which ones have you been on?
So I haven't been traveling directly with the campaigns. I sort of go to a location where either there's, a primary race coming up or a particularly interesting Senate race, and try and find some story angles that I think haven't been told yet. So I've been, in Nevada and South Carolina, New Hampshire, I was in California a few weeks ago, Maryland, Virginia. Just sort of have to pick and choose my spots. So I've seen, there were at one point so many candidates in this race, but I think I've seen the vast majority of them at some point on the trail, trying to get a feel for what they're like on the stump, what their supporters are like, what is the storyline is out of some of their appearances and some of their campaigns in different places.
Is there a candidate that has particularly surprised you in any way, or you really enjoyed seeing, and for any particular reason?
One of my first stories I did for Newsweek, or the first trips I took, was back last summer. I went to Columbus and sat down with John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, and I guess I was always really interested to see how people would respond to him. In some ways, I was surprised he was one of the last ones standing. I thought that he could catch on with a certain part of the electorate, but I also was skeptical that he would have the right tone. And I think he struggled with that as well. He wanted to be really upbeat, but there were times where he wanted to take on Trump too. So he was someone that always kind of intrigued me. In some ways, he was a lot like Huntsman in 2012, and he had a lot of the same advisors. So there was always this question, was it the right message, wrong messenger in 2012, or was it just the wrong message for the Republican primary electorate? And I think that even though he lasted to one of the final slots, I think he probably just didn't quite tap into the frustrations that a lot of people feel right now, obviously.
What is your analysis of this election season overall so far? Different than any other you've seen?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, in some ways, I think the idea that this is happening in a vacuum, which seems to be sort of the suggestion that you draw from a lot of the discussion sometimes, is just sort of like, this is insane. How is this possible? I think that we saw this building, right? We didn't know that Trump would be the messenger for this movement, or Bernie Sanders for that matter, but I think we've seen a lot of the pieces in place for someone like them, a candidate like each of them, to really be successful. And so while I think the individuals sort of who have carried that message have been surprising, I don't think the fact that their messages have been successful is as surprising as some people are acting right now. And so that's sort of my take. It's sort of there's been a gradual progression here, and this is sort of it finally hit like a tipping point in 2016 where we're seeing sort of backlash against the establishment, the elite, the conventional wisdom, quote unquote. And in some ways, it's kind of refreshing because it's nice to kind of break out of some of the tropes of this is how American politics is done, and sort of reassess some of our assumptions. I think it's always healthy to be forced to do that from time to time.
Well, that brings me nicely to your really great piece, which is something that I love talking about, which are culture wars. You wrote in the beginning of May a piece called The End of the Culture Wars as We Know Them, which is on Newsweek.com. Can you go a little bit into this piece and how culture wars have changed over the years, and also maybe a little bit what culture wars are and what they signify?
Yeah, you know, it's something that I think right now people might look at me and say, look at what's going on in Congress with the fight over LGBT, you know, discrimination writers, or look at what's happening with the transgender bathrooms fight and say that I'm crazy, that the culture wars are still going strong. I think that on the one hand, that's fair. I think the debate at the national level and between sort of noisy portions in both parties is still going on. But I think, and what the piece was sort of about, is how the bedroom issues, sort of the culture wars as we think of them, which were really the culture wars of the 70s and 80s that were a lot about sex and personal issues and, you know, whether the government should be involved in your sex life and your bedroom or not. Whether that's contraception, abortion, you know, homosexual relationships, and now transgender, that was really a phenomenon of the 70s and 80s and 90s. But, you know, that's when it started. And so I was examining whether that still has sort of the power that we assume it does, particularly within Republican primary voters. Because you would have thought, if that's the case, that someone like Ted Cruz would have done extremely well, would have won over someone like Donald Trump, even. And that's not the case. And a lot of voters didn't put a priority on the sort of who shares your values question in exit polls. And so when I talked to some experts and asked, you know, is the – you know, are social conservatives no longer as influential in the Republican Party, or is this just a, you know, an anomaly, an outlier election? And, you know, I think in some ways it's a little bit early to draw any long-term conclusions, but I think, you know, there's definitely been a movement away from kind of the bedroom issues as the most salient issue for a lot of really conservative voters, and they have other higher concerns, essentially. And then there's also these demographic shifts that are going on they affect Republicans as well as Democrats. You know, people, including in the Republican Party, are becoming more accepting of gay marriage. Even, you know, you look at Roe v. Wade as an issue, and there's less and less people who even know what Roe v. Wade is. I mean, a lot of that is because it was, you know, a decision that came down in the 70s, and, you know, there's kids born in the 90s and the aughts that, like, just not part of their history as much. And so one of the experts I talked to said that he thinks with Trump, and there was even evidence before this, that really the type of culture war we're seeing now is more, it still has religious undertones, but it's more about this sort of battle, clash of civilizations, Muslim versus Christian, for example. And that actually dates back to sort of the 1900s and early 20th century America, when, you know, there were groups of Americans that were very suspicious of Mormons or Catholics, and worked that into the political debate. So it's really kind of examining the shift that's going on in terms of the way we people are responding to some of those issues that are considered sort of conservative red meat.
Your background is in political science, and you have a master's degree from the University of Oxford. Are there any kind of stories that you like to write because they have more of a political science or history background to them?
Yeah, I really do. I mean, I find myself drawn to things that add a little historical context. I think that we have pretty short memories in the political world in terms of, you know, precedent-setting events, or we have, you know, sort of conventional wisdom of how things work, but we don't really have any empirical evidence to back them up. So, you know, I love some of the stuff that, like, 538 has done, and some of the stuff the New York Times is doing, where they're really bringing in sort of statistical analysis and data. I try really hard to sort of back up my stories with some sort of empirical analysis, because, you know, there's nothing worse than sort of building a false narrative that's just sort of anecdotal to me. I mean, it's hard sometimes. Sometimes you have to rely on anecdotes, and sometimes that's powerful. But if you're trying to assert there's a trend going on, I think you really need to find some sort of evidence. And so I'm making a little bit obsessive about that part of the reporting. Is where is there like, tangible evidence for asserting that this is happening? And, you know, like we all have our successes and our failures in terms of determining that. So I'm not saying I'm always successful at doing that in my pieces, but it's something that having studied political science has made me much more kind of aware of. And being skeptical, too, of numbers, because sometimes, you know, everyone can quote a poll or can, you know, conduct a poll that finds what they want it to say, right? But what's their sample size? What's their sample audience? Like, there's a lot of ways that numbers themselves can be biased, so being able to sort of take a critical eye to the way people are using figures is important, I think.
The counter to what you just said is that people's attention span seems to be getting shorter, and people, as you know, are addicted to Twitter or sound bites on TV. So do you find it harder to get people's attention to really focus on longer piece journalism or articles in print? Or what is your opinion on print journalism in general?
Yeah, you know, I'd agree. I think that it is harder. I mean, there's just more voices out there now. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. I think that it's great. There's so many outlets and people and, you know, reporters digging up great stories and putting stuff out there for people to consume. I think what, you know, print journalism and particularly a magazine need to prove is that there's still a value to sort of filtering and distilling information for people. And I almost think that's even more necessary now than it has been, just because, again, like, I think we all feel it, but, you know, the average person is just inundated with information and news, and being able to sort of take a step back and say, well, what does this all mean? And not just like, here's what happened every day. I think that there's definitely a place for that. It's just convincing people to sit down and take the time. And that's a challenge on us to really like grab people with, you know, compelling narratives and compelling storytelling and doing things on the ground or digging things up that others aren't seeing. And so, yeah, we have to work really hard to do that. And it's, you know, it's always a challenge to break through the noise and the cycle and the endless kind of 24-hour sand bites. But that's sort of a challenge that I've taken upon. It's sort of one of the reasons that I feel motivated to do the work that I do. So
I've asked broadcast journalists a few times what their daily routines are like, and it seems really stressful because they could get a call in the middle of the night to come in and do something. Do you get emails or calls to do a story last minute, or is your day pretty much planned out in advance?
It's a mix of things. I mean, especially with the unpredictability of this race, things that you think are happening one day suddenly change. I mean, my day is definitely not as hectic and crazy as a broadcast journalist. Like, I sort of have, you know, at the beginning of the week, I have a sense of the stories that I want to be working on. But, you know, for example, I was working on a piece that was going to be this big feature for the magazine when it looked like Cruz was really going to be the last man standing against Trump. And then Indiana happened, and we thought, you know, it was looking like Trump wasn't going to, that Cruz wasn't going to pull it out, excuse me. But I don't think anyone thought he was going to drop out that night. And so I was a little bit nervous about sort of this piece was getting ready to go out the door for the next edition. But when he dropped out, it was sort of like, oh, crap, like, what do we do with this story? And so I had to hustle that night and the next day to sort of repackage it as a look back on why Cruz ultimately wasn't able to catch Trump, why he couldn't unite the party, and it ran on the web. It didn't get in the magazine. So there's always that frustration with the pace of news today versus the pace of a magazine cycle, and you have to be pretty flexible on that. And we find that a lot with trying to plan weekly and monthly stories. But we have sort of a rapid response team up in New York that handles a lot of sort of the breaking news. And we have, I mean, the thing about Newsweek is it does have this network of, you know, Newsweek Europe and Newsweek Japan, and there's Newsweeks all over the world in English and native languages. And so we have a desk in Europe, for example, that can handle the really early morning stuff. We have, you know, reporters out on the West Coast can handle late night stuff. So we sort of have some flexibility in terms of dealing with that breaking news. But, I mean, for me, I do always have to, regardless of if I'm writing about it that night, I do need to be plugged into what's happening with each of these primaries and each of these debates and town halls, et cetera. They're trickling, you know, they're flowing to a trickle now, which has been kind of a relief for a while. That it seemed like there was something every night. So, yeah, predict what everyone was going to say for a while.
The final question I always ask is, if someone wants to follow in your footsteps and have a career like yours, what advice would you give them?
I guess I don't know if there is really a traditional route in journalism. I mean, that's one of the hard things about breaking in. For me, I certainly was not traditional in the sense that I sort of bounced around a little bit, and having left D.C. for a few years to go back to school and do my master's degree and coming back, maybe I wasn't on the super fast track, the way some people now right out of college, they're like, boom, like moving up the ranks within a few years. But I think that it's given me a little bit of more textured understanding of politics, and that's really helped my writing. So when I'm able to do a lot of the long form stuff for the magazine, it helps me both frame how I think about the issues, and I think it helps me come up with angles on stories that, you know, in this day and age, there's just everything's been covered and there's a million reporters swarming around every story. I think that's been an asset for me, or a resource at least. So yeah, I think I would advise people to just sort of find a subject area that they really enjoy or are interested in and try and sort of burrow down in it and get some expertise that can help kind of, they can fall back on when they maybe don't know as much about the day-to-day, or they're, you know, feeling like every story has ever already been told. Go overseas in your 20s for a few years, do something kind of that's subject matter related, and kind of get that experience while you have a chance, and then you can always come back to D.C. or come back to the States and start, you know, building up your career from there.
Emily Cadet, political correspondent for Newsweek, thank you so much for coming on.
Great to talk to you.